Now, so for this morning's session, going to we give maybe a talk for about 45 minutes, then have a toilet break, 10-15 minutes, and come back for the final metta meditation from 9:15 to 9:45. So it is very close to the end of the retreat, maybe. Sometimes we always plan for the future, and sometimes things happen that all your plans go wrong. For those who have read my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, many years ago and forgotten some of the stories, there's one of these stories I love telling at the end of a meditation retreat. And that was a friend who was a New Zealand young man. And when he decided to become a monk, he decided to go to the toughest monastery he could find, which happened to be in South Korea. And I think that must have been where Kim Jong-un trained, because that's the sort of stuff which they did. No messing around. No talking, no cups of tea, no biscuits in your room in the evening or whatever else you have in there. No messing around. And it was tough, but he was wanting to get enlightened. And it wasn't just a 9-day retreat. This was 60 days, 2 months. And it wasn't like Ajahn Brahm namby pamby schedule. This was the real thing. You had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. There was a loud bell which would even wake up some of you people. Believe it or not. And they had to get up 3 o'clock. And the reason they had to get up without any choice, they didn't have their own rooms with en suites. They slept in the meditation hall. When it's time to sleep, you just laid out there, got a little mat out, a little pillow, and that was where you went to sleep. So there was no place to hide. Gong in the early morning, and you're up. And it was right throughout the day. 45 minutes of sitting meditation, 15 minutes of walking, 45 minutes of sitting, 15 minutes of walking. And when you did have your breakfast, it was brought to you right where you were sitting. The only time you could get out was to go to the toilet, but even that you had to be get back quickly. You had the Zen stick. And the lunch was brought to you as well. And the only time you could actually really get out of the hall was for your interview with the master. But that master was nothing like Ajahn Brahm. He was fierce and so scary. You know, you'd rather actually sit and suffer than go see that guy. That was really, really tough. Not for cream puffs. And he'd been meditating before, and he was young, he was strong. But even after the first day, finished at 10 o'clock, you can go to rest now. And then people would rest. And as soon as he shut his eyes, gong! It was 3 o'clock already. So it was a very, very, very tough retreat. You know, he said what really upset him was when it got to 10 o'clock, you know, he'd had enough. He just couldn't wait to actually sit down. But you know, there's always these smart aleck monks, these, you know, really tough people. When it gets to 10 o'clock, they just carry on meditating. That really upsets you. Who are they trying to think they are? So anyway, he managed to get through 2 or 3 days. But even after 3 or 4 days of that, his back was aching, his knees were hurting, because he had no sort of exercise. Just slow walking. And so a week was really, really tough. And after a week, he just wanted to go home. It was just too tough for him. But he was a Kiwi. He had national pride. And he thought, oh, these Asians, these Koreans, they're managing to do it. I can do it as well. So it's just ego pushed him through the next week, not wanting to give up. because everyone else was doing it. But it was so terrible. Sometimes he felt like he wanted to cry. It was so hurting so much. Every day, one at a day, and it went so slowly. And soon, of course, he got to the halfway mark. I don't know why people always count the days. It's now halfway. Because when you get to the halfway mark, well, I've done half. You know, I can do the rest. You know, it's about halfway now. It's downhill from here. And he said, also, if I left now, that it would be, it would not be respecting all the effort I've done so far. It would be unfaithful to all the endurance which I've done. So I'm going to do it. So he went into the fifth week, and that was the longest. It was really tough. He was exploding with pain. I couldn't wait for the bell to go, and the bell seemed forever. Just 45 minutes was such a long time. The sixth week was even harder. The seventh week was almost impossible. When he got to the last week of the retreat, only 1 week to go. It's going to go soon. But that last week was an eternity. Especially the last day. Even though you wake up the last day, woohoo! But that sitting on the first or the last day went on forever. As if all the pain, all the suffering was just not really sort of doing its job. We're waiting for the last day to really pull no punches and really give it to him full on. And oh, he said, that was such hard to enjoy that last day. But then he got to the last 45 minutes. The last, only one 45 minutes to go. I can do this. But you know, the last one is always the hardest and the longest. And he was sure that, you know, 45 minutes had gone. He opened his eyes, only 5 minutes had gone. He couldn't believe it. It was hurting so much. Come on, you can make it. But even though it's the very last one, still it was really touch and go whether he'd just run up and scream and just disappear. And he opened his eyes again. It must be 45 minutes. Now, 10 minutes. And that's when he told me he started to imagine, what happened if the batteries of the clock run out? And no one knows it's 45 minutes and it's really... You know, the cock. And he was really suffering. That last one was the longest 45 minutes he'd ever experienced in his life. Absolute agony. But of course, all things must pass. And he heard the sweetest sound in his life. The gong went. Ah. And just waves of joy coursed through his body. He lost all feeling of pain because he'd done it. He'd done a 60-day retreat. He'd endured almost the impossible. It was an amazing achievement. He felt so good about himself. And especially because after those Zen retreats, the first thing you do is have hot baths. It's beautiful. You can just relax in the bath and get all his sore muscles to get relaxed at ease as well. And after that, there'd always be a big feast. And oh, bring on the beautiful rice and curries and dumplings. Oh, bring on the hot baths. And he was just looking forward to that, but there was another gong. And the teacher said, I have an announcement to make. He said, during your interviews, many of you have been saying just what wonderful progress you've made in this retreat. And how beneficial it has been for your meditation. And you've asked me, can we please extend this retreat another 2 weeks? And I've considered that, and I think it's a very good idea. Cross your legs and carry on. And at that, this poor Kiwi monk, he had to cross his legs another 2 weeks of torture. But he told me it never hurt. That last meditation never hurt at all, simply because he had so much anger, so much rage. He was like psychopathic. He was trying to find out which of those bastard monks said this. Who was it? And what he was going to do to them when he found out. He was, you know, all his precepts had gone out the window. And as he was contemplating the slowest way he could torture these people, gong. The bell went again. Half an hour had gone past. And a second. Gong. Retreat's over. bars are down there waiting for you, and afterwards a nice feast. Enjoy. And this New Zealand boy said, what's going on? Are we carrying on? Are we ending? What's happening? And then one of the other junior monks came up to him and says, oh, the master does this every year. And he said he learned more in that last half hour than he did in 60 days. Expectation. That is what tortures you. So, because many of you can unpack your bags, go back to your rooms and carry on. So he said, yeah. But that was because that was a very tough retreat. But that's one of the great insights you've got to know. You can't predict the future, not even the next half an hour. Things always change. Which is one of the reasons why it's best to live in the present moment if you can. If you make any plans, always make them out of rubber, never out of concrete. Rubber can bend. You can change at a moment's notice. Just like the time when I go overseas, and when I go overseas, it's not holiday. As soon as I land, I've got to go somewhere and give a talk. And lots of people are waiting for me. So, I was going to give a talk in Indonesia, and I went to the airport to actually check in on the Garuda flight, and there was a big sign up. Garuda flight, cancelled. Not delayed, cancelled. When's the next flight? Tomorrow. And there, I had to get to Jakarta, and so many people were waiting for me. And they were going to get disappointed if I didn't come. But that's the Dhamma. Get disappointed. You can't expect that just because my name's on a poster, I'm going to arrive. And so I saw so many people, who were probably less important stuff they had to do, getting so angry that these poor people on the counter, who were just representing the airline, they had nothing to do with the plane not actually being able to take off. It's not their fault. But people got very angry at them because their plans had been destroyed. As for me, I always have rubber plans. Oh, if you don't go today, you can go tomorrow. And I did manage to telephone one of the organizers and say, please convey my apologies, but it's not my fault and it's not Garuda's fault either. Because that was the time, if you remember, when they had the bird flu epidemic. And I told the monk who was organizing the talk, please tell the audience that it's because of bird flu, Garuda's a bird, it's caught the flu. That's why I can't go. And so even if Ajahn Brahm could not turn up, at least his bad jokes could. Which was at least something for them. He rescheduled it, did it another time. But that is why you can't have all your plans and just get so upset, you know, when the plans don't work out the way you want it to. Which is one of the reasons why asking for the world to go according to your schedule is asking from the world something it can't give you. Which is why we can let go and just, okay, you know, these things happen. So you can actually reschedule your plans at a moment's notice. So, no expectations. That's actually how we live our life. Yeah, we have plans, tentative plans, but they're not in concrete. So you can always change at a moment's notice. So, yeah, you think, oh, but I'll disturb other people. Well, life is disturbing, and other people should know too. Yeah, I'm not going to try and be there at that particular time, but if it doesn't work out, it's not my fault. And this, for you, is the greatest Dhamma teaching. You know, we always have to adapt from time and place. So during these last few days, the retreat is, maybe, I'm not sure. I'm planning that it's going to end in a few hours' time, but who knows? I'm willing to change. I can always adapt, even though I'm very busy. But nevertheless, this is probably going to be the end of the retreat. And so, no, at this time, one of the other things I'm trying to stop you doing is judging this retreat. Oh, it was a good retreat. Oh, it was the worst retreat I've ever been on. Oh, it was sort of okay, middle way. Middle way would be the best, I suppose. So if you tell me that it's really great or it's terrible, those are two extremes, and it means I've been a bad teacher. If you say, oh, is this all right? Then that's the best. That's the best compliment. Thank you so much. But it's best not to judge at all, because from judging you get controlling, disappointment, frustration, elation, and all these things which actually stop you being peaceful. Which is why one of the stories which I should have said earlier, which actually helps your meditation, is a bit late now, but nevertheless, here it comes. This is a story of this guy called Lord Kelvin, one of the founders of engineering technology, a founder member of the Royal Society in London. And he was once said, was quoted, the only way we can control nature is by learning how to measure her accurately, first of all. It was an important insight that once we had standard lengths, standard weights, really good clocks, we could measure time accurately. Only when you had very accurate measurements could we have what's known as technology. So the first part of science was just getting accuracy, you know, in weights and measures and time. And once that was achieved, we had the Industrial Revolution. But you can always turn statements like that on their head. That if you don't measure anything, then you can't control it. Which means you have to let it be. Many people in our modern world are very, very concerned how much information governments have about us, how they can measure us. From our internet usage and so much other information, because they're afraid that once government can measure you, then they can control you, which is actually a very powerful point. But me, I am off the grid. No one knows. I'm not married. I don't pay any tax. So I don't exist for the government. I'm actually totally free, which is marvelous. And some of the other monks, you know, even more free, they don't actually exist, which is really weird. Because they don't have all of the certificates and all of the data which you give to people as a natural course. Marriages and taxes and pensions and stuff like that. But anyhow, when you don't measure, you can have to let go. So, are you going to measure this retreat? Was it a good retreat, a bad retreat, or like in that great story, who knows? When you don't measure it, you're far more free. Because if it's been a good retreat, then the next time you come, it has to be better. If it was a bad retreat, you won't come next time. Either way, you know, you're giving yourself a lot of problems and trouble. So it's marvelous when we don't judge at all. You don't judge in meditation, which means you can't control it. You have to let things be. And anyway, what is a good meditation? What is a bad meditation? What is a good retreat? What's a bad retreat? As I was just waiting for you, I was sitting out on the stupa, just watching the trees grow. And I don't know if you know, that's a Zen garden with all the blue mat, and we've got the rocks in there. And you know where those rocks came from? You know the rocks in the garden? They were just putting in the fence, and they dug them out, they just bunged them there. But now people say, wow, those rocks, the way they're all put together, that must have been a top Zen gardener to put them there like that. And we've got them now that they've become the Zen rocks in the garden. They're just there because no one's bothered to move them yet and put them where it's meant to go. But it's amazing to see, wow, that is just so artistic. And it ain't at all, they just bunged them there. So, it reminded me of one of my other favorite stories from a long time ago. It was about this Zen garden in Japan, which was supposed to be one of the most famous gardens in the whole of the country. And actually people would visit there, actually pay money to go and admire it. It was just incredibly beautiful and artistic and meaningful Zen garden. So this old meditation monk, he was in the vicinity, he wanted to go and have a look. And instead of going in the usual time in the afternoons when it's open to the public, he decided to go and have a look in the morning time and find out what the secret was of making this beautiful garden. They actually climbed over the fence early in the morning when it was all locked up, and he hid behind a bush. And that's when he saw the Zen monk, the young guy, coming out early in the morning to actually prepare the garden for the afternoon. And the garden had this beautiful plum tree in the middle and lovely rocks and water features. It was incredible. But what that monk did, he had two baskets, and he went through the garden picking up all the leaves and twigs which had fallen the day before from the wind. But before he put the twigs or the leaves in the basket, he would look at them first of all, examine them. And if he thought they were beautiful, the twig just the right curvature, the right shape, or the leaves just the right color of like deep red or gold, if he thought they were nice ones, he'd put them in one basket. And he put all the other rubbish twigs and leaves in the second basket. So he actually picked up every leaf and examined it first of all. He was so meticulous. It took him 2 or 3 hours just to clean the garden. And then he took the baskets to the back of the temple. He put the rubbish baskets full of rubbish leaves and twigs on the compost. And the other one he just put aside. He had a cup of tea. And then he meditated. The most important part of his morning's work. And he took the basket with the beautiful leaves and twigs, and one by one he put them in the garden just in the right place. Maybe just leaning against the rock, maybe just under the plum tree. And sometimes he had this incredible artistic sense that sometimes he put it down, move back and say, no, that's not right, and just turn it a little bit, and then that was just right. And he had such an amazing grasp of the relationships between shapes and colors and the positions that when he was finished after another couple of hours, that garden looked amazing. And then he would actually open it up for visitors. But just before he was going to open it up for visitors, that's when the old meditation monk came out from behind the bush. He said, I'll be watching you all morning. Just the amount of effort you put into this garden is incredible. And your grasp of color and shape is just so admirable. But there's only your garden, he said. Your garden is almost perfect. Now those words, especially the one word, almost perfect, the gardening monk just went on his knees and said, oh, Master, you've been sent by the great Buddha himself. Please teach me, oh wise one, how to make my garden absolutely perfect. Because almost perfect is not enough. Just like you, almost perfect meditation, not good enough. You want it really perfect. So, the old monk said, you really want to tell me to let you know? He said, yes, please. Show your compassion on me. Please teach me, oh Master, how to make my garden really perfect. Okay, said the old monk. And he went right into the center of the garden. And he put his big hands, old, very strong still, around the plum tree. And shook the hell out of it. Leaves and twigs went all over the place. A real mess came under the garden. And the garden monk, my whole morning's work ruined. And the meditation monk said, now that's perfect. And I like that old story because, what's perfect? What's not perfect? That's perfect. As you are, really messy, meditation all over the place. Perfect. Now, if you're going to measure yourself, that's how to measure yourself. Instead of just having some standards of perfection, which is totally artificial, totally made up, like, calling those Zen rocks in the garden over there, then haven't been placed there on purpose. That's where they were left, because people were too lazy to take them away. So, life is like that. So your meditation, had a good meditation, absolutely perfect. I've been thinking and sleeping all week. Because as I mentioned to you, a very important point, It's not the meditation object in front of you which is important. It's your relationship with it. Are you making peace with it, being kind with it, being gentle with it? Or are you trying to make it better? Trying to change it, trying to improve it. Trying to make it so it's some idea which you've read in the book or you've imagined in your fantasies. So, that's with me. As you know, when I first became a monk, I had all these ideas of what a monk should be. And I look at myself and there's none of them what I exhibit now. I never thought monks could tell jokes and laugh. I thought monks had to be serious. I thought they had to have what I called a horizontal mouth. That's when you know you're really enlightened. So that nothing changes you. They tell a joke and you just look like this. They call you an idiot and you just look like this. Nothing. And it was only when you went to see like someone like an Ajahn Chah and you read the suttas, you realised, no, the real monks are real. Human beings who are at peace with themselves. They've let go of wanting and craving. That is what we're trying to get to. To let go of stuff. Not to attain something. So, in this meditation, the more you become at peace with yourself, marvelous. The more you're disappointed because you haven't achieved your goals. You haven't been listening at all. There are no goals. Except to get rid of goals. That's the only goal. Get rid of goals. We don't have bucket lists in Buddhism. Bucket lists. What are you supposed to do with a bucket? Kick the bucket. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what somebody said. The first item on my bucket list is to have no bucket lists. Which is, that's much more wise. So don't have things you have to do. So instead, have all the things you can not do. And tick them off. What didn't you do on this weekend? And if you can tick all those things, many, many things you didn't do on this week, sorry, then well done. Your bucket list is not of things to do, but of things not to do. Which is much more fun. Not to do any work, not to do any thinking, not to do any blaming, not to do stuff. Be at peace with stuff. So, during this retreat though, you have learnt a lot. I always call it brainwashing. You ask any psychologist, and the way you brainwash people is actually to get them to be very still first of all, meditate first of all, and that makes them really open for brainwashing. And then you talk in a very slow voice with lots of emphasizing these S's because that gets underneath your perceptions. Standard brainwashing techniques. That's why people actually, they told me this when at Nolan Mara Center, we always do the half an hour meditation before the talk. You know why we do that for? Because that makes you actually much more receptive to the talk. Your mind is very still, you've let go of all of your critical mind states, which means you're much more likely to be brainwashed. But I say brainwashed, but it's good stuff. You know, teaching you just how to be at peace with yourself. How not to be so demanding. That's why we do the chanting. This is what should be done. Now may you be contented and easily satisfied, not demanding in nature. Especially in your spiritual life. Because the more you want, the further you get away from enlightenment. But when you stop wanting stuff, you let things be, you get still. And hopefully, you've experienced at least some stillness, some moments of peace during this retreat. And if you have, please understand why. Why was that such a beautiful meditation? It usually is the case when you give up. This other type of meditation I really should have taught you before, but you may try it tonight if you wish. Oh, you mentioned about Ananda, the Buddha's chief disciple. And I did actually mention about, in one of the questions, they had this big convocation after the Buddha's death. 500 people went there. It was actually 499 of those were fully enlightened. The odd one out was Ananda. He wasn't enlightened yet. And so imagine to understand what Ananda must have felt. Imagine I make the announcement that everyone on this retreat, every one of you had a jhana, except for you. How would that feel? That hurts. I've been coming here for years and years and years and years. I give jhana to Bodhidharma Monastery and Dhammasthala, and these people, they just roll up and they get jhana straight away. They've got their tattoos. This is unfair. So that's what Ananda felt. The following day, he's going to rock up with all his other arahats, his friends, and he's got nothing. Zero. So that night he decided, right, no sleep for me, no rest. Tomorrow I've got this big meeting, I'm really going to go for it tonight. And he meditated all night, no messing around, enlightenment or bust. And if ever you try that, enlightenment or bust, it's always bust. Every time. So there he was, first thing in the morning, busted. Got nowhere, absolutely nowhere, not even a nimitta or anything probably. So what did he do? Oh, just give up. And he noticed he still had time for a little nap. People don't change, you know, the same. You can find a little half an hour here, an hour there for a quick snooze. Yeah, why not? So he wasn't going to get enlightened, so he went to his room and he went to lay down. And as the story, the well-known story tells us, as he went to lay down, just before his head hit the pillow, he was fully enlightened. He got it. Just like that story of the donkey chasing the carrot. Chasing, chasing really hard, and he gave up, he stopped. And the carrot, poof, poof, right in his mouth. He caught it. Just before his head hit the pillow. And so from that day on, we call that the Ananda method of meditation. Don't take a snooze. And of course, you know, just the more times you try it, the more chance there is of it actually working. So you've got to put some effort into, you know, lying down. Lying down. No, not yet. Well, one day I'll get it. And according to the story, they've got some great stories over there. No need to doubt them. With his enlightenment, he got all the psychic powers, all in one hit. Yeah. Great psychic powers. And so, there he was, fully enlightened, just freshly enlightened, and the meeting was going to be in half an hour. What should I do? Just like modern singers, like, was it Celine Dion or these other people, when they go to a concert, they always arrive late. That is what a VIP should do. Really, I should always arrive late. But anyway, so he thought, no, I'm not going to go on time. Arrive late. So, they'd already locked the doors, started the meeting. And then Ananda, he made an entrance. Because how can you convince someone you're enlightened? You can't come up and say, look, I'm enlightened. And say, oh yeah, I've heard that one before. He decided to really make an entrance. And so they locked the doors. And he came in through the keyhole. Now that is making an entrance. That is smart. And as soon as he did that with the psychic powers and flames, now the whole works, then they realized, wow, yeah, okay, welcome, you're one of us now. Thanks for that display. So, I often say that if any one of you gets enlightened, you can come into my room through the keyhole, please. I say, okay, yeah, fair enough. So that was the fellow was trying for such a long time and then let go. Gave up, abandoned. And that's where all these incredible things happen. So this is the message you're trying to brainwash with meditation. Look, in life you struggle and strive so much. And you have to do that. I struggled and strived to build this place, Bodhidharma, get Dhammasara going. It's a lot of hard work, and you know, later on when I go back to the monastery there'll be more work to do there. But when I meditate, no, meditation's not work. Meditation is really letting go, relaxing, being at peace. And if you understand that, you understand not only the way to get enlightened, also the way to get healthy and happy, and also just the way to relax in your world. You're going out there into this big, busy world. And it's just so crazy. People rushing around all over the place. Which sometimes you have to do. But all the time? That's the crazy bit. People don't know how to stop and take a rest. I call it grabbing on to the in-between moments of life. The in-between moments is a concept where, you know, you say you arrived at the airport and you're waiting for, you know, for the aircraft boarding to be announced. And that's also something really crazy I've seen because I travel a lot. All these people, they can't wait to get on the aircraft. You know, they say we're boarding by rows and they try and get in there before their row gets called. You know, and they're queuing up there. They can't wait to get on the aircraft. But then as soon as the aircraft lands, they're up there with their bags, they can't wait to get out. So I think that's really weird. They should let the people who really want to get on the aircraft, you can get on first, but you also have to get off last. If you like the aircraft so much. Be consistent. But the reason is because people don't know how to relax and rest. You know, when they're sitting there, they're just way off into the future. They weren't going on the aircraft. When they're on the aircraft, they want to get out again. They don't know how to just relax and be. And grab the in-between moments of life. There's so many in-between moments. You're at the dentist. You're waiting for your appointment. You're sitting there. Instead of actually reading the magazines, meditate. Relax. Just be. You don't have to do anything. Just close your eyes and do nothing. Take those opportunities. You're stuck in the traffic. It's not going to move. So what do people do? They start emailing, checking their SMSs. They worry. Instead of doing that, just relax. You're in the traffic, you're stuck, you can't do anything. Just relax. Which is one of the reasons why I was told this, and apparently it's true. I thought it was in Mumbai, but it's actually in Chennai or somewhere. Maybe I might get this wrong. But anywhere, at the traffic lights, they don't have stop. They have another sign, relax. So the stop signs are never called stop, they're called relax signs. So that when you actually get stuck in the traffic or get to a red light, instead of seeing this word stop, you see relax. And I thought, what a wonderful thing that is. If in all jurisdictions, instead of having stop lights, they have relax lights. So they can just take a break. And somebody showed me some clips, some photographs from Montreal in Canada. Great country, Canada. There, bus stops. People who go to the bus stops, you're sitting down there. People don't know how to grab those in-between moments. They've arrived at the bus stop, but the bus hasn't arrived yet. So instead of having just ordinary benches, they have swings. Like in the children's playgrounds. And so all these photographs of all these well-dressed men in their suits and their briefcases and all these ladies in their power suits about to go to work, swinging backwards and forwards while they're waiting for the bus. And apparently it got so popular that sometimes they're enjoying the swing, their bus comes, there's always another one behind, so they just carry on let it go. Thanks for good advice. Now what a wonderful way of grabbing these in-between moments of life to relax instead of always trying to get off into the future. So in a few minutes, just when these things are actually all crikey, when all this talk finishes and you know you have all of the handing the keys, you get all your stuff sort of handed in, you're ready to go. You'll be sitting out there waiting for your car to come, your family member or friend to pick you up. What are you going to do? They haven't arrived yet. Just be. Meditate. Grab those in-between moments of life. And then you find when you learn how to take advantage of those in-between moments, you know how to practice when you get out there. You have much more peace. There's so many hours we waste where we could be meditating, developing a peaceful, calm mind. We throw them away because, number one, we don't recognize in-between moments of life. Between one appointment and another appointment. So we don't grab them and we just allow ourselves to get stressed out. So please recognize in between moments, grab them, close your eyes and just be and relax. And that way you'll find you have far more peace in your day And it means the next time you come to this retreat, you'll be way ahead of the game because you'll be meditating. You don't need a special place. You don't need a temple. You don't need any sort of paraphernalia like a Buddha statue or a Zen cushion. You just grab these moments which come all the time, but we waste them. The in-between moments of life. And anyway, what is life? Life is just an in-between moment, just a big in-between moment. Before you come out your mother's womb, before you go in your box. So please, grab the in-between moments called life. And then you'll be far happier, peaceful human being. So I taught you a lot here, and most of it you think you've forgotten. But that's the other thing. Some people have come on their first retreat, some people have been coming for years and years. I've talked about just basic stuff and also very high stuff like jhanas and just enlightenment and stuff like that, which is, you know, huge stuff. So some of you think, Lord, this is too much for me, talking about the will. Well, I can't understand that at all. It does not matter. It's got inside of your subconscious where it will reside for years. Months, who knows, maybe moments, until it's the time that that teaching actually comes up. Because that's one of the weird things about being with an Ajahn Chah. So many of his teachings I just could not understand. The ridiculous, weird stuff. Even that teaching I told you, when he said, why, Ajahn Brahm? I said, I don't know. And he said, oh, there's nothing. I never understood. Ajahn Chah was totally right. When he asked me, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And he walked away, making me feel so low, so much an idiot. That was really humbling, because when I was at Cambridge University, you thought you were really intelligent. I really believed I was intelligent, because I went to a top university. Then you went to go and see Ajahn Chah, and I realized I was a dummy. He really put me in his place, in my place, which was really great. All that education, and how stupid can you be? Really stupid. So anyway, so I never understood what he was saying most of the time, I thought. But it got in your brain. And then what happens, sometimes you're meditating, you're walking meditation, and you see some Dhamma, and then an answer comes up, and you think, where did that come from? And then you understand, wow, Ajahn Chah said that. And I remember it. I didn't believe it at the time. It made no sense. And it comes up to help you make that next step on the path of enlightenment. It's amazing just how this mind works. Very refined stuff. Teachings like, the donkey. You think you understand it. You don't. But one day you will. One day you'll stop chasing and everything comes to you. Story of the being under the mango trees. Story that there's nothing. Kind of makes sense, but not really. Then one day you're sitting there and, there's nothing. Who said that? Oh my goodness, that's what I heard from Ajahn Brahm. It's Ajahn Chah. That's amazing how this stuff actually works. That's where the insight really happens. It's put inside you as a seed. And then when it's ready, when the meditation is ready, when the experience and all the conditions come together, then it happens. This is one of the reasons why I'm going to stop. I can't stop speaking. One of the reasons why it says in the suttas, for those of you who really, really want to become stream winners, and for Sri Lankans, that's what they really, 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 really want. It's been encouraged in you. Become a stream winner, at least. And there's the two causes for stream winning. One is called the words of another, the teachings, the Dhamma. And the other one is just going deep inside, the Anisamanasikara. So, you've got those teachings. They're in there now. Half of the causes for stream winning, you've got good Dhamma. The next thing you need to do is just go so deep. It's a jhanas, basically. And when you get those jhanas, all those teachings, now I can understand what he meant. Because you're there. You read the guidebook, like Lonely Planet Guide to Jhana by Ajahn Brahm. Lonely Planet Guide to Enlightenment by the Buddha, Ajahn Chah. He wrote the commentary. So you've got all the information. Now you've got to go there and explore, and then you understand what those descriptions actually mean. And that's where all these great attainments happen. Wow, wow, incredible. Don't ever think that, oh, these were just for the time of the Buddha. These days, no one can do these things. That's why I try and teach you. Yes, you can. That's what Obama said. Yes, we can. So this is the Obama meditation. Yes, we can. It's just a matter of time. But for goodness sake, follow the instructions. Then you don't waste time. And those instructions, sit down and shut up. And let the process happen. The more you try and control it, the longer it's going to take you. And after a while, I said, what am I doing all this stuff for? I'm going to just let go. And things happen. Yes. Now you remember the teachings. It works. It's a well-oiled path. People have been traveling along this for 2,500 years, even longer beforehand. It works. So don't think you know better. Just sit down, be quiet, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then amazing things will happen. And you have lots of time. There's so many in-between moments in your life. Recognize them. And you never think that there's not enough time to meditate. So, there we go. It's now 9 o'clock, just 2 minutes afterwards. So now we have a toilet break for 15 minutes. Those who want to go to the toilet or stretch your legs. And afterwards, at 9:15, please be back. We start the metta meditation. And it's been requested, there's many metta meditations, but today I'm going to do the circle metta meditation. If you don't know what that is, you're in for a treat. So off you go. So, do you want to do, okay, come on, let's do sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Quacky. Okay, I always go over the top. Okie dokie. I can have my cup of tea.